Part 4 Chapter 19 The Regency. On the night of August 7th, 2008, Dmitry Medvedev, now the third president of Russia, was on a sailboat on the Volga River with his wife, Svetlana, and their son, Ilya, then just a teenager. It was a working vacation in the languid holiday month. Medvedev had spent the day in the ancient city of Kazan, the capital of Tatarstan, a region conquered by Ivan the Terrible in the 16th century. There, he reviewed preparations for the Universiade, the biennial international collegiate sporting competition, which would be held there in the summer of 2013 as a rehearsal for hosting the Winter Olympics in Sochi 8 months later. He had traveled the day before in a neighboring region, Chuvashia, where he discussed plans to create a modern library network. The morning before that, he attended the funeral of the Soviet dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who had died in Moscow on August 3rd, thoroughly rehabilitated in post-Soviet culture as a state-decorated admirer of Vladimir Putin. Medvedev had been president for 3 months, but it seemed as if he were simply carrying on with the duties he had had as the unprepossessing first deputy prime minister, not the commander-in-chief of a resurgent, nuclear-armed state. His election in March had been no more in doubt than Putin's had 4 years before, even though he had no political base of his own, no particular platform, and no mandate from a populace hungry for change. On the contrary, the entirety of Medvedev's presidency rested on the premise that the people wanted not change, but stability. Had the voters been given the choice, they almost certainly would have elected Putin again, but they had accepted his choice as heir because Putin wished it so. So Medvedev cruised to a convincing victory in a managed election that saw prominent opponents of Putin's rule, including Mikhail Kazyanov and Garry Kasparov, blocked from registering as candidates, as they had been in the Duma elections in December 2007. Kasparov, despite his fame and financial resources, could not even manage to rent a hall large enough to hold a nominating convention, as required by law. Kazyanov was disqualified on the charge that his campaign had forged more than 13% of the signatures needed to nominate him. Another liberal candidate, Andrei Bogdanov, encountered no such obstacles with his signatures. He was a political strategist and a Freemason from the very edge of obscurity, elected the previous year as the Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Russia. The Kremlin orchestrated his candidacy as a fallback in the event no one else bothered to run. Medvedev performed his assigned role, eschewing retail campaigning and refusing to debate his challengers, who in addition to Bogdanov included the old stalwarts who had foregone a challenge against Putin in 2004, the communist Gennady Zyuganov, and the nationalist jester Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Medvedev simply went about his deputy ministerial duties, lionized by the state television channels, with his patron never far removed from the picture. He was Putin's choice, and therefore the only one. He was the heir, the Tsarevich, simply awaiting popular affirmation. The short political campaign was so transparently contrived that Mikhail Gorbachev publicly rebuked the Kremlin. "Something is wrong with our elections," he said. But his was a moral voice of authority from a receding and discredited past, and few paid heed, certainly not the state media. When the ballots were counted, Zyuganov trailed a distant second with 18% of the vote. Bogdanov received fewer than 1 million votes, fewer, in fact, than the number of spoiled or blank ballots. Medvedev, who had no political experience of his own, became the youngest elected president. He was only 43. He won 71.2% of the vote, a tally that was conspicuously and widely seen as deliberately a slight decrease from Putin's 71.9% 4 years before. From the moment he took office in May, Medvedev struggled to emerge out of the shadow of the man who had elevated him to the heights of power. Yeltsin had quietly stepped out of the public limelight from the day he appointed Putin. But now, Putin strode confidently through Medvedev's inauguration. He opened the ceremony in the Kremlin with an unprecedented valedictory speech that affirmed, unmistakably to the assembled elite in the Grand Palace, that he had no intention of disappearing from the public stage. Medvedev hoped to make a quick impression on the world stage, visiting Germany, Russia's closest trading partner in Europe. But Putin preempted his first official visit with his own visit to France. The chairman of the Federation Council's Foreign Affairs Committee, Mikhail Margelov, told a visiting American official that Medvedev was a gifted, if yet unformed, student who had learned from his teachers. But the dean of faculty remained Putin. Putin, he said, genuinely wanted to cede, albeit gradually, the duties of the head of state, especially foreign affairs. But Medvedev struggled to extend his authority over a bureaucracy conditioned, after 8 years, to respond to Putin. Yet, with his mild, bookish temperament, Medvedev at least changed the tone of the Kremlin. During his campaign and his first weeks in office, he spoke of civil liberties, economic modernization, and the need to end rampant corruption and the legal nihilism that characterized Russian politics and society. Putin had offered similar pledges, but Medvedev proved far less bellicose, less conditional. He sounded eager to present a different image of leadership, to prove that the transition was a substantive, not purely symbolic one. Where Putin was steely and brittle, Medvedev seemed gentle and open. He delighted in using modern devices. Steve Jobs would give him an iPhone in 2010, and opened accounts on social websites where he posted photographs he took as a hobby. Despite Putin's prominence as prime minister, many began to believe that Medvedev would carry out the liberalizing reforms that Putin had failed to deliver. One of those who found hope in Medvedev's promise remained in the Siberian cell where he had been confined, Mikhail Khodorkovsky. He was now eligible for parole, and his lawyers appealed in July for an early release. Another was the American seeking to replace George Bush as President of the United States, Barack Obama. As Medvedev's boat rocked in the gentle flow of the Volga that night in August, his presidency seemed to be on the edge of an optimistic new era. Instead, he was about to face his gravest challenge. He had not even reached his 100th day in office. At 1 o'clock on the morning of August 8th, the Minister of Defense, Anatoly Serdukov, telephoned Medvedev with the news that war had erupted on Russia's southern flank. The armed forces of Georgia, led by the westernizing Mikhail Saakashvili, had begun an air and ground assault on the country's breakaway region of South Ossetia. Tensions with South Ossetia and another region, Abkhazia, had flared all year. Both had split from Georgia during short violent conflicts in the early 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and had remained in a diplomatic limbo ever since, recognized as part of Georgia, but in fact independent statelets that sought closer relations and financing from Russia, which maintained peacekeeping forces in both regions under the mandate of the United Nations. In the wake of Kosovo's declaration of independence from Serbia in February 2008, Putin had increased assistance to the two regions. In one of his last official acts as president, he ordered a reinforcement of troops to the existing Russian peacekeeping mission in Abkhazia to oversee the reconstruction of the railroad that had once connected it to Sochi but since fallen into disrepair. The fate of the regions had become an acute focus of Putin's last weeks as president, following a testy confrontation in Bucharest with President Bush and other NATO leaders debating whether to invite Georgia and Ukraine to join the military alliance. Throughout the summer of 2008, Russia and Georgia traded accusations that the other intended to launch an invasion to resolve what had become known as frozen conflicts. Medvedev held a series of meetings with Saakashvili, who also hoped that his presidency would represent a shift from his endless confrontations with Putin that had followed the Rose Revolution, including a trade embargo in 2006 prompted by the arrest of four Russian intelligence agents. Saakashvili had proposed political settlements for the two regions, which Medvedev initially seemed amenable to, but when they met in Kazakhstan in July, he sensed that Medvedev was no longer interested in discussing them, as if he had been reined in by other powers in Moscow, that is, by Putin. A conflict seemed inevitable, and the Russians had prepared for it thoroughly, though they suspected it would come in Abkhazia, not South Ossetia. The military had already drawn up plans for an intervention. Putin would later say that the plans had been in place as early as the end of 2006. In the summer, on Medvedev's orders, commanders amassed forces for a large training drill in the Northern Caucasus, within striking distance of either Abkhazia or South Ossetia, a feint that would become a signature of future military operations in Russia. Nevertheless, Medvedev that night was surprised and skeptical of the urgent report interrupting his river cruise. "We should check this," he told Serdyukov on the telephone. He thought, "Is Saakashvili completely out of his mind? Maybe it's just a provocative act. Maybe he is stressed, testing the Ossetians, and trying to send us some kind of a message?" He asked the minister to call him back. Putin had already left Moscow for Beijing, where he, not the head of state, planned the next day to attend the opening ceremony of the Summer Olympics with dozens of other leaders, including President Bush. Serdyukov called Medvedev back an hour later to say that the reports were true. Georgia had begun an artillery barrage on South Ossetia's capital, Skhinvali. "All right," Medvedev said. "I'll wait for another update." He claimed he could not reach Putin in Beijing on a secure telephone line. That he felt the need to try showed he was uncertain whether to commit Russian forces to battle outside the country's borders for the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union. His hesitancy would come to haunt him. Finally, Serdyukov called a third time. A rocket had crashed through a tent full of Russian peacekeepers, killing all of them. This would prove to be an exaggeration, the first of many that would be uttered in the days that followed. But the fact was that Russian troops and their proxies in South Ossetia's irregular militia were under assault. More than 4 hours after the rockets began falling in and around Skhinvali, Medvedev at last issued the orders to go to war. "Return fire," he told Serdyukov, and then he rushed to fly back to Moscow. By the time Medvedev arrived, Georgian battalions were moving into South Ossetia. Russian aircraft began striking not just inside the region, but in Georgia itself as well, hoping to forestall the advance. The word of the Georgian assault reached Putin in Beijing, and he was enraged. At Saakashvili primarily, but also at Medvedev's lack of resolve. Putin, speaking to reporters in the morning, made the first public statement on the crisis in China, vowing that Russia would retaliate for the Georgian incursion. He made repeated calls to Medvedev, who on the morning of August 8th met with his Security Council. It was 10 o'clock in the morning when Medvedev made his first public statement, well after Putin's. He declared that Georgia had breached international law and committed an act of aggression that had already cost lives, including those of Russian peacekeeping troops. "Civilians, women, children, and old people are dying today in South Ossetia, and the majority of them are citizens of the Russian Federation," he said. "In accordance with the Constitution and the federal laws, as President of the Russian Federation, it is my duty to protect the lives and dignity of Russian citizens wherever they may be." By midday, Russian forces surged across the border. President Bush was also in Beijing when an aide whispered into his ear that a Russian offensive had begun in Georgia. He was standing in line at a diplomatic reception in the Great Hall of the People to greet China's president, Hu Jintao. Putin stood a few places ahead of him in line, but protocol mandated that Bush speak to his presidential counterpart first, so he waited until he returned to his hotel to call Medvedev warning him to halt the counteroffensive. "We're going to be with them," Bush told him, referring to the Georgians. What President Bush did not understand was the extent to which the Russians blamed his administration for the conflict. Even if he had not given a green light to Saakashvili's plan to seize South Ossetia, as the Russians suspected, Bush had bolstered Saakashvili with military training and the promise of NATO membership at the summit in Bucharest in April, despite Putin's personal warnings to him that an invitation would provoke Russia. What Saakashvili did not understand was that for all the effort he had used to win over the Americans, praising Bush and dispatching troops to serve in Iraq, neither the United States nor NATO was prepared to come to his aid in a war against Russia. The miscalculation cost Georgia dearly. In his conversation with Bush, Medvedev compared Saakashvili to Saddam Hussein and told Bush that the Georgians had already killed 1,500 people, a glaring exaggeration. It was clear now that Russia had no intention of pulling back. Bush eventually confronted Putin in Beijing at the Bird Nest Stadium as they awaited the Olympics opening ceremony that night. They sat in the same row of VIP seats, and Bush asked his wife and the King of Thailand to slide down so he could sit beside Putin to deliver a warning. With an interpreter leaning in awkwardly, Putin rose from his seat, momentarily looming over him until the taller Bush could stand fully upright, and told him Saakashvili was a war criminal. "I've been warning you Saakashvili was hot-blooded," Bush said. "I'm hot-blooded too," Putin replied. Bush later wrote that he had stared back at the man he had met with more times than any other world leader except Tony Blair. He had hoped to forge a new relationship with Russia, one that would overcome the mutual suspicions of the Cold War, only to realize he had misjudged the man when they first met in Slovenia in 2001. "No, Vladimir, you're cold-blooded," he said. After meeting with Hu Jintao the morning after the opening ceremony, Putin left Beijing and flew back to Russia. Not to Moscow, but to the bustling staging ground of Russia's full invasion force. He arrived on Saturday night at the headquarters of the 58th Army in Vladikavkaz, the capital of North Ossetia, the Russian republic on the northern slope of the Caucasus that had been sundered from its compatriots on the Georgian side by a decree of Joseph Stalin. It was Putin who appeared on state media, receiving the military updates from the generals in uniform on the ground, while Medvedev delivered pallid directions from his Kremlin office. Putin said Georgia, emboldened by its flirtation with the United States and NATO, was seeking to devour South Ossetia, and now would lose it forever. "What's happening in Georgia is genocide," he said, in a fury that overstated the reality on the ground. By then, Russian tanks had reached Skinvali and then pushed forward beyond Ossetia itself, toward the Georgian city of Gori, Stalin's birthplace. Russian warships blockaded the port of Poti, south of the border with Abkhazia. Georgia's forces, despite years of American equipping and training, crumbled in disarray, unable to effectively communicate because the Russians had jammed or disrupted cell phone coverage, their only means of communication. A humiliated Saakashvili had to plead for help. The United States airlifted 2,000 soldiers that Georgia had deployed to Iraq as part of the American war there, and President Bush later sent additional aid and equipment, but he also made it clear that the United States would not come to Georgia's side militarily. More than 100 American military advisors who had remained in Georgia after the summer exercise withdrew to avoid becoming entangled in the fighting. With Georgia's fractured troops retreating in front of a Russian thrust toward the capital, Tbilisi, itself under bombardment, Saakashvili had no choice but to sue for peace. Putin ostensibly accorded due deference to his protege as the commander-in-chief, but the entire system, the bureaucracy, the military, the media, had become so conditioned to his role as paramount leader that it struggled to preserve the appearance that Medvedev was in charge. Putin himself was unable or unwilling to recede into the background, suggesting instructions in televised meetings during the crisis that Medvedev dutifully passed on. In public, Putin sought to emphasize Medvedev's preeminent post, but in private, he hectored and cajoled his interlocutors, still very much the leader. When the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, flew into Moscow to mediate a ceasefire on August 12th, he found Medvedev calm and sanguine, able to negotiate. Putin also attended the meeting, however, and he was bombastic and crude, seething with a ferocity toward Saakashvili that seemed deeply personal. Sarkozy pressed the Russians to call off an invasion that now seemed intent on reaching Georgia's capital and overthrowing its president. The foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, had said as much to Bush's Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, demanding Saakashvili's removal from power as a condition of peace. Lavrov also belittled Medvedev in a conversation with the French ambassador, even as the leaders met in the Kremlin to resolve the conflict. Sarkozy argued that the world would not accept the toppling of an elected leader, but this only further enraged Putin. "Saakashvili! I'm going to hang him by the balls," Putin seethed, startling the French leader. "Hang him?" he asked. "Why not?" Putin replied, sounding petulant. "The Americans hanged Saddam Hussein." The only thing that seemed to temper Putin was Sarkozy's asking him if he wanted to go down in history with a reputation like Bush's. It was early the next morning, after Sarkozy flew to Georgia's capital to seal Saakashvili's agreement, when Medvedev announced a ceasefire in the conflict's fifth day. He appeared alone in the Kremlin and adopted a Putinesque tone to declare that the aggressor had been punished. He looked pale and tired. Despite the ceasefire, Russian forces consolidated their positions in the vacuum created by the routed Georgians, while the militias of South Ossetia conducted a campaign of pillaging and looting the homes of Georgian villagers inside the region, often under the eyes of the Russians. 2 days after the ceasefire, even as Condoleezza Rice flew into Georgia to deliver a pledge of political and humanitarian support from the United States, a Russian armored column pushed eastward toward the capital, stopping only 25 miles from Tbilisi's city limits. The last Russian troops would not withdraw from Georgian territory for another 2 months, and even then, they left reinforcements behind in South Ossetia and Abkhazia. On August 26th, as the debris of the war was still being cleared, Medvedev announced that Russia would recognize the two enclaves as independent nations. He and others cited the precedent of Kosovo, whose declaration of independence 6 months before the Russians had called illegitimate. Despite some obvious shortcomings by its forces, the war fed a nationalist fervor in Russia, amplified by state media glorifying the actions of the Russian liberators and vilifying the enemy with an intensity not seen since the Great Patriotic War. The glory, however, redounded to Putin as much as Medvedev, since it was clear to everyone that he remained the paramount leader. Medvedev occupied a presidency with diminished authority for the simple reason that Putin had effectively taken its powers with him, along with much of his presidential staff, to the Prime Minister's office, located in the White House at the opposite end of Novi Arbat from the Kremlin. Medvedev remained the nominal head of state, but his handling of foreign affairs was muddled and confused because he had to vet any fundamental decisions with his Prime Minister. His own efforts to echo the commanding, aggressive, and unflinching tone that Putin wielded so deftly often proved embarrassing instead. On the day after voters in the United States elected Barack Obama in November 2008, a moment widely celebrated around the world as the end of the Bush era of unbridled American aggression, Medvedev delivered his first national address since his inauguration. After the poisonous relations at the end of the Bush presidency, in which Putin even suggested that the United States had instigated the war in Georgia to boost the chances of Obama's opponent, John McCain, it might have been a moment to welcome the change in administrations. As he spoke in the Grand Kremlin Palace, though, Medvedev did not even mention Obama. He blamed the United States for the war in Georgia and threatened to deploy ballistic missiles in Kaliningrad, the Russian enclave in Eastern Europe annexed as tribute after the Great Patriotic War, if the Americans built their missile defense system in Europe. Instead of coming across as tough-minded, Medvedev sounded tone-deaf. It was not even clear he believed his own bluster. The making of Russia's foreign policy had been notoriously opaque and unwieldy since Yeltsin's era, but with two centers of political power, it became even more so. Medvedev apologized for his remarks during his first visit to Washington 2 weeks later, where he met President Bush, though not the young president-elect. He claimed it had been a simple oversight to deliver his provocative warning on the day that leaders around the world were congratulating Barack Obama. "With all my respect for the United States, I absolutely forgot about the important political event that had to take place that day," he said improbably. "There's nothing personal here." As with the war in Georgia, Medvedev seemed to trip over his own feet, or Putin's. A second crippling blow to Medvedev's nascent presidency came only weeks after the war in Georgia ended. The windfall from the steady increase in oil and gas revenues had stimulated the country's economic boom, driving up retail sales of everything from foreign cars to furniture and food. The economy had grown by an average of nearly 7% a year during Putin's presidency. Putin had paid off the country's foreign debt, amassed hundreds of billions of dollars in currency reserves, and, resisting pressure to spend freely, built a stabilization fund that would shield the country from any downturn. Newly installed in his post as prime minister, Putin acted as if his greatest legacy was irreversible. Coinciding with the political transition in 2008, however, Russia's economy began to slow. With inflation rising, the new prime minister sought to exert his will on the market and the oligarchs. In July, prodded by complaints from energy executives about the rising costs of steel for pipelines, he convened a meeting of the metals industry in Nizhny Novgorod, the purpose of which became clear when he singled out the billionaire owner of Russia's largest steel manufacturer, Michel, for selling its coking coal on the domestic market for higher prices than abroad, thus avoiding taxes. Igor Sechin was the one who had brought the matter to his attention, reportedly because of the economic pain Rosneft was feeling. The company's owner, Igor Zyuzin, already under pressure from clients and competitors, made the mistake of skipping the conference and checking into a cardiac hospital. Putin's response was cutting. He suggested that perhaps the anti-monopoly authorities, even the prosecutor general, should inquire into the company's affairs. "Of course, illness is illness, but I think he should get well as soon as possible," he said. "Otherwise, we will have to send him a doctor and clean up all the problems." By the end of the day, Michel's shares, traded on the New York Stock Exchange, lost more than a third of their value, nearly $6 billion, dragging down Russia's already slumping markets. Michel swiftly released a contrite statement promising to address the prime minister's concerns, but Putin had sent a clear message. He had no intention of taking his hands off the tiller of Russia's command economy, intervening whenever he felt the impulse and undercutting Medvedev's early efforts to nurture a more attractive climate for investments. Medvedev and his aides appeared surprised by Putin's assault. One of his senior aides, Arkady Dvorkovich, sought to calm the markets, but days later, Putin reiterated his accusations that Michel was evading taxes, sending its shares plummeting a second time. Putin acted as if Russia were invincible, an island of rising prosperity impervious to the financial storm that had been brewing all summer, from the moment the price of oil peaked at more than $140 a barrel. The global economic crisis triggered by the mortgage defaults in the United States in 2008 seemed at first to pose little threat to Russia's economy, since its banks had not issued the sort of subprime mortgages that had turned toxic. But the bankruptcy of the American investment bank Lehman Brothers on September 15th the same day oil slipped below $100 a barrel, reverberated around the world, and it hit Russia harder than most. By the end of the following day, the main stock index had dropped 17%. Panicked selling forced the suspension of trading repeatedly over the coming weeks, and even with government intervention to prop up shares, the market lost $1 trillion in a matter of months. Between October and December, $130 billion in capital flooded out of the country. While fewer Russians were invested in stocks compared, for example, to Americans, many of whom saw their life savings evaporate, the crisis hit Russians hard, from the poorest to the richest. Disposable incomes fell almost immediately as companies slashed costs, dragging down consumer spending, which only made production shrink more. Even the swaggering oligarchs were pawning their yachts and selling their private jets. Russia's booming economy went bust so precipitously that Putin found himself presiding over a meltdown as grave as the crisis of 1998. It seemed like a bookend to the decade of prosperity that had undergirded his presidency. Within days, the government had approved $40 billion in credits to shore up banks and another $50 billion in loans for 295 companies that accounted for 80% of the country's economy. The central bank struggled to slow the decline in the ruble's value, draining nearly $200 billion from the currency reserves, a third of the peak of $598 billion reached in August. Putin's conservative macroeconomic policies, balancing budgets and building up reserves and a rainy day fund, despite populist appeals from some in the Kremlin to spend more freely, proved prescient. Even now, Putin felt pressure to bail out the favored oligarchs and renationalize distressed companies ripe for taking over on the cheap. Yet, he sided with the advisors who urged caution, shifting more decision-making power to those who knew about and could do something for the economy, as one of the government's economic advisors, Sergei Guriev, later wrote. The liberals, allied with Medvedev, including the finance minister, Andrei Kudrin, seemed to have prevailed in the short term, and none of the worst predictions of economic collapse came true. The effort was costly, though. Russia's economy contracted 8% in 2009, the worst performance among the world's 20 largest economies. For the first time, Putin's popularity slipped significantly, dragged down by popular discontent that at times spilled into the street as workers protested unpaid wages. In his 8 years as president, Putin had always been able to deflect criticism toward the government, which was headed by the prime minister. Now he held the post, and he deflected the blame elsewhere. He lashed out at what he saw as the external cause of Russia's woes, the United States. In October, he took the unusual step of visiting the Duma to meet the communists as a bloc of delegates for the first time in all his years in power. The gesture reflected his apprehension about the impact of the crisis on voters, pensioners, laborers, and those still nostalgic for the Soviet era, who supported the only opposition party holding elected office. The communist leader, Gennady Zyuganov, dutifully called for more spending on key industries like agriculture, lamenting that Russia's production of harvesters and tractors had fallen behind that of Belarus, and denounced as ineffective Kudrin's monetarist policy to control the circulation of rubles. He also used the opportunity to plead with Putin to ease up on the harassment of his party's candidates in regional elections. Putin had little interest in the communist proposals, though. Zyuganov and his cadre were simply a foil for Putin to deliver a populist message. When the United States plunged into the Great Depression, Zyuganov noted in a long, rambling discourse, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had sent his best economic advisors to the Soviet Union to learn a thing or two. But now reckless American capitalist greed had brought calamity to the world. Putin, with the cameras rolling, was happy to agree. You made a good point when you said that the faith in the United States as the leader of the free world and market economy has been shaken, as well as the trust in Wall Street as the center of this world, he told him. and it will never be restored. I agree with you here. Things will never be the same again. The crisis highlighted the underlying structural weaknesses in Russia's economy, its dependence on energy resources, the crumbling industrial base, the pervasive corruption, the eroding infrastructure. The country had fewer miles of paved roads in 2008 than it had had in 1997. Economists like Sergei Guriev argued that Russia should heed the lessons of the crisis and enact meaningful changes, and advisors to Medvedev's Kremlin, like Arkady Dvorkovich, agreed. Russia's economy needed the rule of law, the protection of property rights and contracts, real competition and transparency, and some constraints on predatory and corrupt officials who would shake down companies and bleed their profits into their own pockets, hiding the illicit proceeds in foreign property and secret offshore accounts. Medvedev's team in the Kremlin had drafted proposals to address at least some of these issues. In his first national address, the one he delivered the day after Barack Obama's election, he called for a liberalization of the economy, freeing it from the bureaucracy that had grown under Putin's leadership. The state bureaucracy, as 20 years ago, is being guided by the same old mistrust in the free individual and in free enterprise, he said in the speech, which had been twice postponed because of the financial crisis. A strong state and an all-powerful bureaucracy is not the same thing. The former is an instrument which society needs to develop, to maintain order and strengthen democratic institutions. The latter is extremely dangerous. The twin crises of the summer and fall, however, deflated Medvedev's political aspirations. His closest aides blamed the crises for derailing his agenda, but Putin was the biggest obstacle. Putin had vetted drafts of Medvedev's first major address in November 2008, a role no prime minister had played when he was president. He insisted on hawkish language toward the United States and the West generally that made Medvedev uncomfortable, hence the threat to put missiles in Kaliningrad. Worried about the political fallout from the economic downturn, Putin had also insisted on inserting another proposal in his protege's speech, one designed as a potential safety valve in the event the economic chaos threatened the political system itself. Early drafts did not include it. Putin had proposed it while meeting with Medvedev the day before the speech. When Medvedev dropped it into his remarks, almost as an aside, a single sentence in a speech of more than 8,000 words. Not even his closest aides knew it was coming. Medvedev called for revising the Constitution, something Putin had steadfastly resisted for years despite numerous entreaties, insisting that altering it would undermine political stability. The proposed change would extend the president's term in office from 4 years to six, and the term of Duma members from 4 to 5. Medvedev offered no explanation for the change, only the justification that many democracies, like France, had longer presidential terms. He later insisted that the amendments, the first changes to the Constitution since it was drafted in 1993, were only adjustments that did not change the political and legal essence of the current institutions. In fact, they further strengthened the presidency and reduced the frequency of the election cycles that Putin had feared would become the focus for a color revolution. The proposal stunned the political elite, especially since no one then understood the rationale behind it. Speculation swirled that the ultimate goal was to clear the way for Putin's return to the presidency following a surprise Medvedev resignation. The change was carried out like other Putin special operations, swiftly and surreptitiously. Within 9 days, the proposal barreled through the Duma, with only the communists, his pliant prop only weeks before, opposing it. By the end of the year, the change had passed both houses of parliament with little debate, and certainly no input from the public. The beleaguered Democrats tried to muster protests against the amendments, as well as against the government's failure to turn around the staggering economy, but they faced relentless harassment from the Kremlin and its proxies, especially the youth groups that the Kremlin had nurtured. In that winter of discontent, Garry Kasparov, Boris Nemtsov, and Vladimir Milov, and others tried to form a new opposition coalition, hoping to use the economic crisis to fuse together a dissident movement. They called it Solidarity, after Poland's opposition group, formed in the grimmest years of martial law. But the opposition remained deeply atomized, consumed by personal rivalries and divided over tactics. Some of Putin's critics still hoped to work within the system to bring about change. Others wanted to spark a revolution. Still others refused to join out of a personal dislike for Kasparov or Kasyanov. Solidarity held a founding congress one weekend in December, but had to go to extraordinary lengths to keep its location and timing secret. Previous efforts to meet had been scuttled when venues canceled after phone calls from the authorities. The tactics against even a marginal opposition movement underscored the Kremlin's anxiety, but at the same time demonstrated its ability to smother any effort to organize anti-Putin sentiment. When Solidarity's leaders finally met at a conference center in the suburb of Khimki, a busload of activists from the Youth Guard, affiliated with United Russia, arrived to harass the attendees. Their bus was loaded with sheep, wearing hats and t-shirts with Solidarity's emblem. Other protesters wore masks and threw bananas, the first of what would be many racist allusions to the new American president, the first of African heritage to hold the office. The message was crude but clear. Putin's opponents were animals, shepherded by the nefarious hand of the United States. The activists pushed the sheep from the bus, many of them injured or ill. The sheep staggered, bleeding, on the pavement, where several of them died. On December 30th, just before the New Year holidays, Medvedev signed the legislation that changed the Constitution, the most significant change in the country's political system since Putin's cancellation of gubernatorial elections in 2004 went from proposal to reality in less than 2 months. Less than a year into his presidency, it was clear that Medvedev was merely a junior partner in the tandem governing the country. Putin might outwardly defer to him as head of state, but he continuously upstaged him. In December, Putin went ahead with his annual appearance at the year-end call-in show, fielding 70 questions carefully screened from around the country. He vowed that the effects of the economic crisis would be minimal, promising to raise pensions and benefits for the unemployed. Putin's performances undermined Medvedev's political authority, making it harder for him to tame the bureaucracy that he wanted to change. Medvedev never betrayed his objections in public, but privately he expressed frustration, and his closest aides deeply resented the interference they constantly encountered from the Prime Minister's office. Medvedev struggled to enlist supporters in the bureaucracy, but Putin's loyalists occupied too many places, including within the Kremlin. After the war in Georgia, secret surveys of the Russian military showed the absolute abysmal regard commanding officers had for the new commander-in-chief. The final authority ultimately rested in the White House now, and everyone understood that. In the biting words of one American diplomat, Medvedev was playing Robin to Putin's Batman.